What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Bradley Tusk is a venture capitalist, political strategist, and writer. He is the founder and CEO of Tusk Holdings. Tusk Ventures is the world's first venture capital fund to work with and invest solely in high-growth startups facing political and regulatory challenges. Tusk Philanthropies is leading the U.S. efforts to allow people to vote in elections on their phones. Bradley also recently wrote a memoir called The Fixer, My Adventure Saving Startups from Death by Politics, and he hosts a podcast called Firewall. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
Skirt, skirt! Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, Crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at Crypto.com. Go help your boy out, tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit Crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you gotta do is go to coinmine.com, you buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right, you purchase it, it shows up at your doorstep, you pull it out of the box, you plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi, 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
As many of you know, crypto investors store their digital assets on exchanges or in cold storage for long-term safekeeping. However, this strategy doesn't help them grow their investment holdings or build overall wealth. With the new BlockFi interest account, users can now securely store their Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. 6% is an absurdly high rate. It's the best rate in the industry. I highly suggest you go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, that's BlockFi.com/pomp to sign up and start earning crypto today.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys. I've got Brad Lee here, bang bang. I'm super excited about this. We've got lots of stories to cover. He's got all kinds of wild ideas and doing a bunch of cool stuff. So thanks for coming to do this.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with your background. Everyone knows you, I think, as the man who helped Uber overcome all of the regulatory issues. And you've done a bunch of stuff since then, but you actually started out in politics.
Yeah, I did. So I kind of got into politics, like I got into tech kind of by accident. I'll tell you that story. But I also got into politics kind of in a super weird way too. So,
would you run for like a high school student body president?
No one would have voted for me. I was definitely not cool enough to do that. When I liked politics a lot. I thought it was interesting, but I was a first generation American. Mm-hmm.
Where's your family from?
Russia. Mm-hmm. Didn't have any money. We didn't know anybody. But in 1992, the Democratic Convention, it was the Bill Clinton nominating convention, mm-hmm. was here at the Garden. Mm-hmm. And my dad had a friend who was a lawyer for the Carpenters Union. And this guy, Brian O'Dwyer, great guy, called me up and said, hey, I can get you like a one-day Carpenters pass to the convention. Do you want it? Sure, that'd be great. So if you look in the newspaper, it says convention noon to midnight. Now, having now been to a bunch of these things, it's really like 8 to 11, and the rest of it's nothing's going on, but I didn't know that. So I show up at noon, and the garden's empty, right? It's like two guys running for state rep in Montana on the stage, and like nothing else. But a guy named Ed Rendell, who at the time was the mayor of Philly, was sitting in the audience by himself, and I had just finished my freshman year of college at Penn. So I was like, all right, you know, he's the mayor of Philly. I go to school in Philly. I'll go say hi. What's the worst that could happen, right?
Yeah.
And now that I know Rendell, he was definitely just talking to the empty chair. Like, he's talking either way. It's just there might be a human being nearby. There might not. And so
he would love to have a podcast then.
He had a sports radio show.
That's amazing.
In Philly. He became a sports radio host after he was done being governor.
You're not joking about him having something to say.
No, he's awesome. I mean, and that's a rough fucking place to do sports.
For sure.
So we have a nice conversation, and he said, oh, when you get back to school, you're busy. And I'm like, no, not that much. It's college, I don't know what to do. And he said, do you want an internship? I said, that'd be great. He said, okay, send me a note, we'll set it up. So I go home, I write a letter, and what I didn't know then, but what I know now, is that correspondence is the black hole of government, right? Everything goes in, nothing comes out.
Mm-hmm.
But every day I'm going home, I'm opening up the mailbox, there's no letter. So I get back to school, and this is, you know, almost a decade before 9/11, so security's not what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this insane thought of like, I'll go see him. So I show up at City Hall, and I get to like, not his office, like the outer secretary, and I said, is the mayor here? And they like were kind of stunned because in it's a crazy question. The only people who do that are either people who are genuinely crazy, which I wasn't, or people like protesting, which I wasn't. I was just this like gullible, naive kid.
They're like, wait, this kid actually may be lost?
Yeah, they're like, what? And they're like, finally, they're like, do you want to leave him a note? I'm like, okay, sure. So I write the note, get back on the subway to go out to the dorm. Kind of hits me on the subway, like, fucking idiot, you can't just go see the mayor. Like, cross that off your list. And I got to the door and the phone rings and it's the mayor. And they said, hold for Ed Rendell. And he said, when are you coming to work? And I said, I'll be right there. And then worked for him all through college.
And you just went right back?
Yeah. Yeah. And worked for him all through college. They kind of mainly blew off glass for a couple of years and worked at City Hall.
What were you doing?
So it was very cool. He was really trying to revive Philly and did a really great job of it. In fact, there's a really good book called A Prayer for the City by Buzz Bissinger, the same guy that wrote Friday Night Lights, about all the work that Rendell did to revitalize Philly. So he set up this office of, called Policy and Planning, where it was just, he just took this really smart group of people and said, come up with good ideas for city government. And then I was like, you know, basically would do the research or whatever it is. And so one of the projects I was doing was they wanted to come up with a way to lure smart graduates out of college into city government.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was researching other cities' programs, because this stuff existed in some places, I met the New York City people and they looked at me and said, how old are you? And I was like, you know, 20 at that point, or 19. They're like, why don't you just apply for our program? I'm like, okay. And then ended up spending the summer between my junior and senior year of college at the New York City Parks Department.
Okay.
And it was awesome because it really touches, you know, it was like the summer, the office is in Central Park. Mm-hmm. Commissioner was this wacky, crazy, brilliant guy named Henry Stern. And you're just going around the city to like every park and playground and doing weird shit all the time. So went back as the press secretary and did that for about
2 years. Hold on. You interned and then you went back like the next summer or after you graduated?
What I decided to do is I was going to my senior year, but I took like a whole bunch of classes and graduated in a semester instead of a year and went back in January.
Got it. And you're the press secretary.
Yeah. So I'm doing the press and, you know, just like opening up playgrounds. And, but, you know, we're coming up with all, like any weird thing. So this guy would, he would do anything to get attention both for himself and for Park. So you could like dress him up in a crazy costume, anything to get press. Like I remember Groundhog's Day 1 year, we dug a hole in the ground, we dressed him up as a groundhog, we buried him in the ground. And then when the press came, he popped up. And the front page of Newsday the next day, this is when Newsday was still a paper in the city, was a picture of him in the groundhog suit with flakes in the forecast as the front page. So it was this crazy but really fun couple of years. Went to law school, but knew I didn't want to actually practice law, so just kind of got the degree. Went back to Parks, did that for a couple of more years, and then went to Washington as Chuck Schumer's communications director, where I had arguably the worst job in all of Washington, D.C., because Chuck, as some listeners here may know, is the most, well, until Trump, you could confidently say Chuck is the most media-hungry member, person in Washington, most politician.
All right, before we get to this, hold on, I have one question for you. So you said something earlier that was interesting about the programs to try to get young, kind of intelligent, hungry kids out of great schools into politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How big of a problem is it in terms of the quality of the people that we have at both the national and state level?
It's a great question, and it is not only having a problem, it is the biggest indicator of the success or failure of a city. So
okay, interesting.
I ended up working for Mike Bloomberg, both at City Hall, and I was his campaign manager. And the thing that made Mike, and I don't know your views on Mike, but I'm going to bet you like him. The thing that made Mike so successful, if you made a list, let's say the 250 things I got accomplished in 12 years, he didn't think of any of those things. What he did was he just hired the most talented people he could get. He said, I don't care about diversity, quite frankly. I don't care about politics. I just want the most talented people I can find. And then he said to every one of them, okay, you're the people who report to me. You got to hire the same way. Mm-hmm. So every kind of non-civil service job where you had discretion was just filled with incredibly smart people who mm-hmm. normally would never work in city government. And then he said, okay, you know what? I'll let you loose. Come up with ideas.
Yeah, what's your best idea?
Yeah, and if you fail, but it's a good idea and you went about it responsibly, that's fine. I'll take the heat. No problem. So mm-hmm. people felt comfortable. Like, you know, we talk, like, I had all kinds of crazy ideas. And you'd be like, okay. and like sometimes they really were. Sometimes they didn't.
What was the craziest one?
We made him the first politician that they could find in history who publicly announced the status of every single one of his campaign promises, whether it was done, not done, failed. So when Mike, in his first year, this was 2002, it was rough. So we're coming off 9/11, city economy is really bad. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of things that became necessary or popular over time, like the smoking ban. But the smoking ban was actually very unpopular when we did it. Mm-hmm. Or he raised property taxes because he had to stabilize the tax base. Ultimately worked out, but unpopular at the time.
Obviously unpopular.
Yeah. So I remember sitting in City Hall thinking, like, we're not going to re-elect this guy and his charm and charisma because, like, our numbers are terrible. So, like, what could make him different? And, you know, even after being around him a few months, I understood that he was just a different kind of person. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I've never since for again worked with a politician like this. He's mm-hmm. completely unique. And I was like, what if we just make him the most transparent, ethical mayor in history, and we just own everything, right? And just if we accomplish something, we take credit for it. If we failed, we own up to it. Any other politician, if you propose that to them, so would just like have fired you on the spot. So I made a list of like 380 things he promised in the 01 campaign. I just went through like every transcript, every newspaper article, everything, and I pitched it to him, and he's like, okay, great idea. And then we went and did it. And
what percentage of things he had?
We had probably done about a third of them.
That's actually pretty high.
Not bad. We were probably working on another third, and then another third, nothing at all. And we actually had to change my mind category as well. I'm just like, because, you know, he'd never worked in government before. There are ideas in the campaign that once he got into the city, he realized, like, okay, that doesn't make sense, and that's fine.
This is my biggest thing with politics is somehow changing your mind when you get more information is seen as a negative rather than a positive. It's the one thing I just can't.
I can't believe you only have one problem with politics. But
well, yeah. It's the one that no matter how much people try to explain to me why it is, I still like, no, but like that is the sign of intelligence, not the
sea is the hobgoblin of little minds, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
For sure. So my Bloomberg, though, is obviously, you know, kind of the opposite of all of that.
For sure.
Yeah, so he was just this sort of incredibly unique guy, and it's really hard to kind of compare him to anyone else. And I've learned that lesson the hard way sometimes, like, oh, what if we just sort of, this person seems like Mike, why don't we try this? And the answer is they're never like Mike.
Really?
But yeah, and you know, part of the way that got done is usually the politics is one thing, government's another. So I went and sat down with every commissioner. I said to like Ray Kelly, like, hey, how would you get on these 17 promises? And he's like, well, what promises? And it turned out some of them he was doing anyway. That's how we kind of had a third roughly, you know, done. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it was like, oh, okay, I'll start working on this. Or sometimes like, well, I don't know if I want to do that. And I'm like, look, if you want to make an argument as to why it's a bad idea, I'll take it back to Mike. But if you just don't want to do it, that's okay. But we're having a press conference. And we're announcing the status of every single one of these things. So Mike is going to publicly announce that you're bad at your job. If you're comfortable with that, it's okay with me.
Sure.
Turns out nobody was comfortable with that.
Yep.
So amazingly, people got to work. So he was really, really unique. But getting back to your question, it's critical, right? Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, cities are neither inherently clean, safe, and well-run, nor inherently dangerous and poorly run. Mm-hmm. It's as good as the management, right? Yep. And the reason why New York City, you know, for a long time has been pretty solid is, for all of Rudy's craziness right now, when he was mayor, he was actually a pretty good mayor. Mm-hmm. So that was 8 years. And then Mike just governed in this completely businesslike, nonpartisan, independent way that just no one's ever done before, right? So you had 20 years. Now, de Blasio's managing to, like, destroy a lot of it. But they built up so much talent and processes that made sense and worked that it's the city's been holding on.
Do you see kind of – you've – operated at all levels of government, right? Yeah, and then now on the regulatory and legal side, you still kind of touch a lot of that stuff. Yeah. Do you see a significant advantage for folks who have business experience and operate it from a management and executive type approach versus other approaches? Or is that more so there's fiction than fact?
Well, there's some value in the actual governance itself. So Mike really did try to treat city government as much as he could like a private enterprise, mm-hmm. and it worked really well. The track record of really rich people running for office and winning is pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mike won. So in New York, we don't realize that because we had him. Mm-hmm. But most of the time when some CEO runs for office, they get killed. They spend a ton of money. Consultants sort of suck all the money out of their campaign, mm-hmm. and they get no votes. So
why?
Because running for office is really hard, and it's totally separate skill set from anything else. It's a separate skill set from holding office. Mm-hmm. And Mike only won because of 9/11. You know, all of a sudden this incredibly terrible, unprecedented thing happens. Everyone's mindset flips on a dime. Mm-hmm. Rudy is sort of deified as this guy who sort of did a really good job in the moment. He endorses Mike, and all of a sudden people said, you know what, I don't care about partisanship. I just want a competent person. And mm-hmm. The guy running against the guy named Mark Green, who was like a total hack. So you had a hack on one side, you had this sort of billionaire, you know, tech
founder. Makes it more obvious.
Yeah. And he only won by 50,000 votes in a city of 8.6 million people. So it was really close, but he eked it out. But if not for 9/11, we lose by 25 points.
Wow.
And then the reelects were, you know, a function of his performance as mayor, and I like to think at least the one that I ran, function of our campaign. But nonetheless, it's pretty rare. So in all of these places, cities can really succeed, they can really mm-hmm. fail, and it really depends on the quality of people you put in. And so in the last two elections, New York City is 8.6 million people. Mm-hmm. Bill de Blasio in the primaries, and in those cases, the primaries really were the general election. Mm-hmm. He got 312,000 votes in 2013, 282,000 votes in 2017. Roughly 4% of the city's population picked this guy, and we get what we asked for, right?
Is the turnout that low?
Yeah, it really is.
Wow.
And you get really shitty governance and really bad mayors mm-hmm. when nobody bothers to show up. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened, and that's why a guy like de Blasio, who hates the job of being mayor. The New York Post reported that he spent, you know how many hours he spent at City Hall in the month of May total?
I'm going to guess that he spent 4 hours every other day. So let's give him 15 hours a week. So we'll go with 60 hours.
Okay. So if you subtract 53 from that, you'd be correct. 7 hours the whole fucking month. I mean, he literally...
Come on, man. I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt.
I saw that. I wanted you to go as high as possible to make the point. He just doesn't like being there. Doesn't like the job. And it's, you know, because the job is, it's not a job about ideology. It's a job about, like, you know...
It's hard.
The trash and the water and the streets. It's hard. And you got to really care about operations, right?
Yeah.
If you don't...
Good luck.
Good luck. And that's what we're seeing right now. But lots of cities have that problem. On the flip side, a city like Philly, which was really falling apart, mm-hmm. you had a really good mayor like Rendell, and he was able to really help bring it back. Mm-hmm. So the good news is cities can get better. The bad news is they can get worse. Mm-hmm. So if you're a property owner here in New York City, it's really important who the mayor is, because the value of that investment mm-hmm. is significantly impacted by the city's overall quality of life.
Yeah. Let's go back to Chuck in Washington. What was that experience like?
You know, insane, brutal, but a really good learning experience. Chuck is famous for having a press conference every Sunday. Every Sunday. Now, he has one every other day of the week, too. But on Sunday, it's his big one because he's right. The local newscasts have like the highest ratings of the week because people are home mm-hmm. and no one else is working. So you can kind of just dominate it. So a huge part of my job.
That's actually pretty smart.
He's brilliant. Just ask him. He will tell you how smart he is.
Sounds like other people.
Yeah, exactly. Huge part of my job, which is coming up with like nonsense for every Sunday.
Like what was the most ridiculous?
Like, I think we did one about like the high price of breakfast cereal. I think we had something about like windshield wiper fluid. We were always forming these like blue ribbon commissions, which meant nothing. Or one trick is we would send a letter to some company protesting something. And you know,
and then you got announced that you sent the letter.
Yeah, and then they're not there on Sunday, right? So it's a one-sided story. But I started noticing that the response from the people that we were going after kept saying, we never got the letter. And then it hit me, the point of it was only the press hit. So once the press conference was over, I kept forgetting to actually send the letter. So I ended up having a post note on my computer that said, remember to send the letter. So we just made up all kinds of shit. But actually, in a weird way, the job was sort of split in two for me, because exactly a year into my tenure there is when 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. So then for a good 6 months, the work we did went from being like pretty superfluous because Congress does mm-hmm. so little, two really important, in part because Chuck was securing lots of federal aid to help New York City recover,
yep.
and in part because people did need to see their leaders, and it really made a difference. And Chuck and his work ethic really worked out well because he was willing to go to everything,
yep.
you know, be with well, people, help them.
He wanted
the attention for sure, but at that moment...
But he cared.
He genuinely cared. He really did. And at that moment, it was what the city needed. You know, because of that, I saw Rudy in action this whole time, and like... Just showing leadership in a moment like mm-hmm. that is really, really critical.
Well, one of my my favorite stories from 9/11, which obviously, you know, this horrible event, but and there's video of it on YouTube, is when President Bush comes and yep. visits Ground Zero, and the video that's online is basically, you know, he grabs a bullhorn, he's standing and he's kind of rallying.
I was about 15 feet from him when he did that.
Okay,
yeah.
So you probably know the story even better yeah. than I read it, which is. He didn't plan on doing that.
No.
He said he was kind of just walking around. I was like, oh, these people need someone to tell them, like, it's going to be okay.
It was, look, I'm not a Bush fan. Mm-hmm. I'm actually, at this point, a political independent. I hate both parties, but I'm certainly not a Republican. And I thought that he was incredible in that moment.
Right? Really?
I was totally inspired and was screaming and cheering and everything yeah, yeah. else. You know, he jumps on top of the fire truck. You know, I hear you, and soon they're going to hear you. And it yep. was... It was an incredible moment, you know, and he really did at that moment show great leadership. I don't think he ended up being a great president overall, but it was electric, I think. And even the Democrats there, they might lie about it, but like everyone was yeah. caught.
Well, and it's also, you said earlier, right, kind of all of the partisanship goes away in those moments where people just say, hey, look, we're American.
Yeah. Right. Doesn't happen very often, especially yeah. given the climate we have right now. But that was a moment where everyone just said, you know, doesn't matter. We just got to try to do the right
for
thing.
For sure. And then how'd you end up in Chicago?
So kind of a crazy story. So I'm at City Hall.
Okay. In New York.
In New York, working for Mike. We had mm-hmm. just launched that whole campaign promise thing. Mm-hmm. And my phone rings. And we're, in, you know, it's a bullpen in the Bloomberg world, right? Mm-hmm. No one has an office. We're on. He doesn't either. He's just in the middle desk. And then we're all, and my office today is like that, you know, the same thing. And it's a guy I know who said, how'd you like to be the deputy governor of Illinois? And I said, what's a deputy governor and why are you calling me?
And who the fuck are you?
Right. And so a guy who now is named, you're going to know, named Rod Blagojevich, mm-hmm. had kind of come out of nowhere to win the governorship. No one expected him to win. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really have like a team
yeah.
because he was a congressman, which means he had very little staff. And
he was a congressman before,
yeah, before
okay,
that.
I didn't know that.
He was a congressman before that. But, you know, congressman of like, you know, 9 employees, whatever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Not people have state had 70.
They're not ready to run the
right.
state.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but what they understood about him was they needed someone that was young enough that it'll be such a career-making job that you would put up with all of his insanity. Like, I truly believe that if Rod had pled insanity at his trial, mm-hmm. they would have had to have given it to him. Now, the problem is crazy people don't think they're crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he never pled insanity and ended up yep. with a 14-year jail sentence.
Yep.
But they needed someone that, like, I was 29, right? It's like, okay, yep. you're 29, and you get to run all of the operations, the whole budget, legislation, policy, and communications for the fifth biggest state in the country. Okay, I'll put up with pretty much anything for the opportunity yep. to do that, and I did. And it was an insane 4 years, because Rod had a both highly logical and illogical view of things, which is his job was to run for office.
Mm-hmm.
And he did his job effectively. He won. And he would literally say, I did my job. And like
oh
he wouldn't
God.
Come to the office for 3 or 4 months at a clip. He had no interest in governing.
Where was he?
Home. He really, whatever the agoraphobia, whatever the phrase middle like to leave their home, he yeah. has that.
Okay. Interesting.
He would go for like 6 to 8, he was in great shape. He'd go for like 6 to 8 mile runs every day, a lot of stretching, watch a lot of Sports Center. He had 3 biographies of Napoleon. But not a lot.
Those are interesting combination of things.
Yeah, he's in some ways a brilliant guy, and in some ways not. But
what's the Kanye saying? Show me a genius who's not a little crazy.
Yeah, right? For sure. And in tech, we certainly understand that. But it took me a few months to understand that. Like, he just had no interest. Like, I remember the first legislative session ends. They pass typically 400 or 500 bills in a session, and most of them are nonsense, like the official amphibian of Illinois is the frog or whatever. But like, there's like 100 that like actually matter for public policy. And so you like have the lawyers review it, the budget people review it, the policy people review it, there's a recommendation.
The protesters show up
yeah,
over some
and,
nonsense.
And I'm trying to meet with him to say like, okay, what do you want to do in these bills? And he won't come to the office. I'm like, well, can I come to you? And it's like, no, I'm reading or whatever. So finally, like, well, do you know what you want to do in these bills? I'm like, well, I have my opinion. He's like, all right, just do that. And then that was it. And then from there on out, every bill, every dollar spent in the state budget, every piece of policy, pardons, granting them, denying them, whatever else. Like, I just did it.
That's crazy.
Not because I was in any way qualified. I was 29 years old, but there was no one else to do it, right?
That's fucking wild.
It was nuts.
Talking about the pardons, one of the things that I've talked to a number of people on, everyone from Mike Novogratz, et cetera, that have come on, is around criminal justice reform and kind of all this stuff. And the one stat that blows my mind is if you are up for parole, there is a number of studies that show stupid facts. Like the closer you are to lunch before the lunch hour, the less likely you are to be approved. Right.
Wow. Yeah.
And so like you want the 9 a.m. slot rather than the 11:30 slot.
Right.
Right. And just human nature. Yeah. They want to get it over with, you know, all this stupid stuff. And we're talking about people's lives and time in jail and all stuff. What's it like being on the other side where I'm sure people are constantly asking for pardons?
Constantly. And it's in a weird way, it felt like even more responsibility than, say, the budget or legislation, because if you let someone out and they hurt somebody, that's really on you. Right.
Oh, so that was the downside.
Yeah. Politically, but also just morally. Right. Like it weighed heavily on me. So basically, I set up a policy and said, if you're a violent offender and your crime was in the last like 5 years, 7 years, whatever it is, and you're still in your jail sentence, like, no, like, we're just come back later. If you're nonviolent, okay, then we're open to it. And look, generally speaking, the world has evolved in a way with criminal justice reform where I think people generally now think that most nonviolent offenders probably shouldn't be incarcerated in the first place. So that was how I tried to divvy things up. And I didn't mind granting pardons if someone clearly, you know, was a not violent person and could get back into society. But I'd never want to take the risk of someone physically getting hurt. And so it kind of worked out.
Pretty rational.
Also, you know, Illinois, I don't think it doesn't, but we still technically had the death penalty at the time, but we just put a complete stay on executions. And then anybody who we could show there was any evidence at all, DNA, that they were actually wrongly convicted, you know, we were just releasing them right away.
The one of the most fascinating aspects of politics to me today is the interaction between the actual political legislation and kind of that whole process with the law enforcement. So you see in places like Baltimore where, you know, the DA just says, look, you guys can keep arresting all these people for, you know, kind of possession of small amounts of marijuana. I'm not prosecuting. Yeah. So I'm essentially decriminalizing it without actually changing the law.
Yeah.
And you really start to see where the power comes from in terms of the legislation versus the enforcement of those legislation. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes, I think people who work in politics, especially if you work in the legislature, tend to think like, okay, we passed this bill, therefore we solve the societal problem. No, we passed this bill, and now there's some program that can try and probably will fail, but can at least try to solve this problem, right? And often what happens is then the people who are executing it that really have most of the power, because how they actually go about it really determines what does and doesn't happen. Like, if you, all the time people come to me and say, I want to run for Congress, I want to run for city council, whatever it is. And my answer is always like, if you go work in the executive branch, like the average like staffer in the mayor's office is much more powerful than like any, almost any city council member, right? Because they're, they take it and then they have the power to do everything with it, allocate money, choose how things are enforced, not enforced, whatever it is. Like the reality is you don't need to run for office to have an impact in government. In some ways, that's the worst way to have an impact in government.
Yeah, that makes sense. What was your take when all the stuff with Rod was going down?
I mean, so the way that I kind of ended it with him was, so it was towards the, it's 2006. So I've been there for 3.5 years at this point. And to his credit, he never ever like did anything illegal around me until he slipped up once. So Rahm Emanuel, who at the time was a congressman from Chicago, then later became the mayor of Chicago, had an athletic facility in his district, and I guess Rod had promised him $2 million in state money to help fix up the facility. That's pretty normal stuff, right? Fine. So,
and that's more of, hey, there's a problem, I have discretionary budget.
Exactly, but, and that's just normal. But there were a few things not in my portfolio, and one of them were grants, which later it's because turns out they wanted to use those for their own purposes. But so Rahm calls me, and if you're watching Entourage, Ari, who's his brother in real life, but Rahm's like, you know, every call is like, fuck you, hangs up, yells, screams, curses some more.
And if you only heard one call, you'd be like, wow, that guy's really mad.
He's a nut,
but then you realize.
No, it's fine. You know, I used to like put him on speakerphone and invite people in to like just listen to it like it's a show. Hey, Rahm's on, let's fuck with him. So Rahm's going crazy on me about this thing. I don't even know what he's talking about, right? I'm like, when he finally stopped yelling, I was like, let me look into this. I'll call you back. So that night, I'm on the phone with Blagojevich. And I just said, hey, by the way, I don't even know what this thing is, but Rahm's really upset. You know, do you want me just to, I can make sure the money gets dispersed. Like, not particularly hard. I took two calls. And he's like, no, Ari, who's his brother, Ari Emanuel, who's the chairman of Endeavor, owes me a fundraiser, and they're not getting that grant until I get my fundraiser. I said, you can't really link these things. One's politics, one's government.
Yep.
He said, you tell them about my fundraiser. And I was like, okay, that's clearly illegal. So I called our ethics counsel and reported it and said, you better put a stop to it. And they did. The fundraiser never happened. The grant was given. But I ended up testifying in both of Rod's corruption trials to what was he was charged with attempted extortion of Congressman Emanuel.
And in that situation, when that goes down, let's say that you had reported it. What I want to really understand is, like, the government oversight. So these ethics committees and stuff, right? Yeah. They're all there. And I think there's, like, a false sense of security in that, like, hey, there's a committee, right? My guess is they don't get used nearly as much as they probably should be. But when they do, can it be preventative? Or is it always kind of retroactively and then they're going in and enforcing?
The preventative is usually, like, ethics training and trying to teach people the right rules. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Yeah. In this case, it was preventative in the sense that we were able to get out ahead of it and make sure that it didn't happen, but more because our general counsel was Bill Quinlan was a really talented guy who could figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, it worked in that case. But once that happened, my kind of relationship with Rob was basically over, and I left a few months later.
Yeah, and to me, you know, it is the first time I've heard kind of the details of it, right? But a lot of what's going on right now in politics with Trump and Biden and Ukraine and all this crazy shit. What I think for the like layman who's never worked in government, frankly, doesn't have a huge interest in understanding how it works. But when you see this stuff, it's hard to tell what is kind of par for the course, right? Of just like, hey, we're negotiating versus, oh, no, you stepped over the bounds and like you actually violated the law.
For sure. Or even Biden, right? So let's just for sake of argument stipulate that Biden didn't do anything corrupt in terms of trying to fire the prosecutor in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about Joe Biden.
Joe Biden. Yeah, yeah. His kind of deadbeat kid still got $600,000 for being on the board of this company that really he obviously had no specific knowledge about, but because his dad was vice president, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this inherent soft corruption that exists. Yeah. And you know, I'm for anyone but Trump. But nonetheless, you know, that I think people in the system just feel entitled to, right? Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders' kid got like $100,000 to run some public policy institute funded by the state of Vermont. Mm-hmm. The Clintons are, you know, the most sort of entitled in all of that. Mm-hmm. Trump is sort of in a whole different level of corruption. But ultimately, I think where politicians in Washington doesn't get it is, yeah, there might be legal lines, but most people don't get to like leverage their dad's power to get a whole lot of money, right? So I don't think Biden's going to survive this.
The two that throw me all the time, and I say they seem common sense to me, but again, I'm coming at it, you know, not nearly as much experience as you, is one, if you are elected, you cannot legislate on topics that pertain to the industry that funded your campaign. So Big Pharma put you in, you know, essentially by funding your campaign, you shouldn't be allowed to legislate on Big Pharma issues.
Right.
Right. Yeah, it probably solves some of the problem.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is this like legal, it's not really insider trading, right? But basically the ability to buy and sell stocks based on legislation.
For years and years and years, it was not illegal for members of Congress to actually trade stocks based on their own information from Congress. And then finally they realized like,
okay, so now they can't do it anymore.
Now they can't do it. And there's a congressman named Chris Collins from Buffalo who was indicted a few weeks ago, or maybe a week ago, and resigned for taking knowledge he had as a congressman and making stock decisions.
Because the and I forget who it was, it may have been Matt Levine, I may get it wrong, but somebody was basically saying like, so take that similar type of framework, right? And go to, so Amazon's going to bring HQ2 to New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you know that they're going to pick New York or you're inside of the local government and you start issuing permits, you know, doing all this stuff, and somehow that information is used for somebody to go buy real estate, and then all of a sudden the real estate is going to get jacked up, et cetera. Is that illegal? Is it not? Is it just unethical? But, you know, it's legal. You know, you get into all these weird complexities.
And here's the thing. Government and politics, like everything else in life, has a lot of gray, right? Mm-hmm. Most things are not. Like, I got lucky that the time that Rod asked me something illegal, it was pretty black and white. Like, no, this is stupid. So, like, so it was clear to me, don't do this, right? But the reality is, like, that's more the exception. The norm is something where it's like, okay, these people are donors to your campaign. They endorse this thing. This is this policy they're for. That they want to see happen, and you want to make them happy, but maybe you also believe that thing too. So is that pay-to-play corruption, or is that just ideologies that are compatible with each other? Like, this stuff is really
super
complicated. And in fact, it has gotten, in the last couple of years, harder to convict public officials of corruption because the Supreme Court said, if something is gray, you can't really do it. So for example, in 2016, I launched what ended up being a totally failed campaign to get de Blasio out of office.
Interesting.
I was of this view, and I'm biased. I was Mike's campaign manager and all that, so like I'm not objective in any way. But he reminded me a lot of Rod, right? Which was he's incredibly lazy and incredibly corrupt. De Blasio was under seven separate federal criminal investigations, all for basically bribes in one form or another.
Really?
Yeah, all for basically, you know, the people would give him money, and then the public policy that they wanted all of a sudden became theirs. And I took the legal standard that was used under Blagojevich and said, if there's seven of these things, like one of them's going to hit, he's going to get indicted, and then I'll put someone else in. And I didn't even necessarily care who it was. I just wanted someone who was like work hard and
ethical.
Not be stealing, right? And the reason I lost is the DA and the U.S. attorney stood up one day, and it was February of 2017, and they said, we believe that de Blasio broke the letter of law and the spirit of law, but we don't have enough hard evidence to bring charges. And I put out a statement an hour later saying, I respect it. They did their investigation. And if there's no indictment, I'm not going to attract a top tier candidate into the race. So he's going to get reelected.
Yep.
But it was really based on the fact that where I fucked up was I took the legal standard used in Blagojevich, and in the intervening couple of years, there wasn't that much time, this case McDonald got handed down by the Supreme Court, and I was aware of it, but I didn't really factor it in enough. And so the standard changed, and whereas before McDonald, they could have brought charges against de Blasio and know they were going to win. Post McDonald, like, oh, we might not win. City mayor of New York City is a big deal, right? And so I miscalculated that, and as a result, I lost the campaign.
Yeah. I mean, look, it is what it is, but at the same time, I mean, it's just facts.
Yeah, and look, I did it for the right reasons. I was, you know, the largest independent spender in the 2017 election. It was all out of my pocket and, you know, tried to do what I thought was right.
Yeah.
But I got it wrong.
Uber. How'd you... How'd you meet Travis
first? So it's a weird story.
I'd love people who start off with it's a weird story because that means it's a good story.
I think so. So I'm sitting... The Bloomberg campaign in 2009, I run the campaign, we win. And I start my first company. It's a consulting firm that runs campaigns for big companies. So Walmart was one of my first clients. And the kind of thing where they'd be like, okay, we want to build a store in downtown Boston, New York, whatever it is. And there's union issues, there's zoning issues, there's community issues. And it was on me to figure out how to overcome all of those and make it happen. And so I'm sitting in a Walmart meeting, it's early 2011. And a friend of mine called, a guy from the Bloomberg world, and said, hey, there's this guy with a small transportation startup. He's having some regulatory problems. Can you just do me a favor and talk to him? And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And 2 hours later, I'm on the phone with Travis. I don't know who or what he is, right? It's a tiny little company. It's a tiny little startup. And we're talking about it. I'm thinking, okay, this is actually pretty interesting because this guy is taking a really shitty industry in taxi and wants to blow it up.
And what is he saying on the phone that makes you think it's interesting? Is he telling you like data? Is he telling you his vision?
He's telling me his vision. What he said to me, and I remember this so clearly, is he said, one day, no one will own a car. They will all drive themselves and you'll get them by pressing a button. And the truth is, for whatever challenges and problems he's had, he's going to be right. And there's no one in the world that came closer to bringing that to reality than him.
That's pretty fucking impressive. Yeah. That was his view.
This was early 2011. Yeah. And so I'm like, you know what? All right, this sounds interesting. And look, it was my company. I could do whatever I want. I don't have partners or investors or anything like that. So I'm like, all right, fuck it. And he's like, and they call us back. Hey, I can't afford your fee. Would you take equity? I didn't know what equity meant, right? I had no idea. Wow. And I was like, okay. That ended up being the best decision I've ever made.
What did he give you in equity?
So I ended up with a couple of $100,000 in Series A equity that turned out to be like, at one point I was like up like 250x. Now the stock has fallen, so I'll probably settle at more like 150, 175x, but pretty good return.
Yeah.
And that was how
I don't even need to know what the original was. Up 150x is pretty good.
Yeah. And so, but what we did that was really interesting and fun, and I think formed the basis for how kind of tech started dealing with politics is, you know, we were this little company and taxi was this big cartel. I mean, now, you know, everyone thinks of that the other way around, but We couldn't compete with them on lobbying or campaign contributions or all of the normal ways the game is played, right?
All right, so before we go into this, because I want to I want to talk about like the hand-to-hand combat you guys did, because I've heard wild stories, and I got the source of truth here now. So what was the challenge that he was facing? Because it was specifically coming into New York.
It was New York, right? But to be clear, so he'd only they were only in San Francisco at that point.
Okay.
And he'd had that problem there.
He had had the problem there. Yep.
We had it in every single market in the country.
Okay.
Which is the local taxi industry did not want competition, and they were politically savvy and influential enough to lean on the local politicians to say, shut these guys down, they're violating the law. And in every single city that I can recall, we got a cease and desist letter saying you have to stop. Mm-hmm. And the thing that Travis did that was so brilliant, two things. One is, to his credit, he's like, fuck it, we're just going to go in anyway and push as far as we can. And what he understood is, if you let the genie out of the bottle, right? Think about the first time you used Uber. Yep. Now you're annoyed because it's supposed to be 4 minutes, take 7 minutes. But that you're like,
magic.
This is magic. Magic. This is the most incredible thing ever. Right? And by everyone listening to this podcast, no matter how annoyed you are with your Uber right now, it was magical.
And it wasn't just one piece, like I pressed a button. It was pressing the button. It was getting in the car. It was when not having to pay when you get out of the car. Like the whole thing was magical.
The whole seamless experience. Yep. So what we knew was if we could show that to people, and the juxtaposition was this like shitty taxi experience where they're dirty and they're mean to you and it smells bad.
And you know that they're screwing you somehow.
It's all wrong. That we could maybe get our customers to be our advocates politically, right? And this was the big bet that Travis had the insight around, which was, I think what we're doing is so special that people will fight for it. And then we had the ability through the app to reach all of our customers and say, here's the issue. It started in D.C. The city council, at the behest of taxi, put in a bill that would have totally wiped Uber out of the market. And you know, we had lobbyists. We were doing the normal stuff, but I knew we couldn't compete on those grounds. And we did a test run. Travis put out an email to every customer in the D.C. area and said, hey, here's who we are. Here's what we're trying to do. It's a binary thing. Either we survive or we don't. If you like what we're doing, can you please email your council member? And we just gave a list of everyone's email addresses. It wasn't even like automated now where you like press a button and it automatically, like I think it was pretty manual and analog. And like in 3 days, 50,000 people.
Holy shit.
Emailed their council members. The bad bill was defeated unanimously. The sponsor of the bad bill voted against her own bill. We wrote a new bill that was passed unanimously. And that was the basis for what ended up being how ride sharing was legalized in every market in the US, which is we were consistently able to mobilize our customers and ended up over time being a couple of million people tweeted, emailed, texted, in some way used technology to tell their local officials, I want to be able to do this thing. And the reality of the way politics works, and stop me if this gets boring, but
no,
like,
no, go.
So you're a city council member, right? Your only goal is re-election. You don't give a shit about anything else. So you need money for your campaign. So for as long as you can do the bidding of your donors and not have any political problems as a result, you're going to do that. That's the smart politics. But like in a typical New York City council race, turnout's tiny, 15, 20,000 people, despite how big the city itself is. If all of a sudden that number of people from your district are emailing and texting and calling you and saying like, I want this thing, you're like, all right, well, fuck taxi, because like they're gonna vote me out of office if I do this. So all right, you got what you want. Like politicians make incredibly rational, logical decisions based on self-preservation at every single turn. And if you understand that that's the basis for all of their decisions, then it's not as hard to sort of get them to make the decisions you want them to make.
Yep.
If you can prove that, hey, if you do what I want, you'll get reelected, and if you don't do what I want, you won't get reelected. Yep. And with Uber, we were able to amass enough numbers that they felt that, and as a result, we won.
I remember in New York at one point, people would open the app and there was no cars.
Do you remember what that was called, that option?
What?
De Blasio.
De Blasio. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was, right?
Yeah.
And then basically it was like, if De Blasio gets his way, this is what Uber will be, right? And there's no fucking cars, and good luck. And people were pissed.
Pissed, yeah. And like, you know, same thing, in a matter of, I remember I'm sitting in, this actually like literally, I'll plug my book here. I wrote a book about a year ago called The Fixer, and it's a memoir about tech and politics.
That's a badass name.
Thank you. My publisher actually thought of it, not me. But
sorry, you take credit for it, it's your book.
Yeah, I wrote the book. this is the start of the book, which is I'm sitting in the Dallas airport. It's like a random Tuesday in June. And I'm not even working with Uber at this point. It's a year they've set up their own operation. Yep. You know, I'm just friends with Travis. And Travis calls me and said, did you see what De Blasio did? And I'm like, no, I'm like in stuck. It's like raining. My flight's canceled. I'm like, no.
What other crazy shit did he do?
Really, right. And he said, check it out and call me back. So I Googled it, called him back. And he's like, how bad is this? I'm like, it's really bad, because if the mayor and the speaker of the city council both want something to happen, historically, we couldn't find a single example in the history of New York City where it had not happened, right?
Wow.
And he's like, well, you got to kill this thing. And I was like, I think I don't fucking know. And then I just said, listen, how much can I spend? And what is there anything I can't do? And to his credit, he said, whatever you need, whatever you want to do, it's just blanket approval on anything you want. And so I get on a flight standby. I'm like, last row, by the bathroom, middle seat. But my brain's just churning on this thing. And like literally kind of a halfway over like the Ozarks, whatever, it hits me like, you know, de Blasio prides himself on being like this great progressive icon. And he's a symbol of justice and equality. And like, what if we attacked him from the left? Everyone always attacked him from the right. He's going to make crime go up. He's anti-business. He's anti-cop, whatever it is. But like, what if we said that this is a racist, anti-immigrant program, and we basically say he's a total hypocrite and he's really not woke? And we ran the whole campaign through that. So we had all these drivers who were immigrants saying, why is he taking away my livelihood? And because, you know, and I think any person of color listening to this podcast knows that taxis have this terrible history of just passing people by, even though they're available, if you're black or brown.
So, and that's like very academically proven.
No question. It's indisputable. So we had lots of African American and Latino customers saying, like, this is the only way I can get home, right? Because taxis won't take me. And we were able to basically combine that with all the grassroots through the app, and built so much pressure that we kept picking off council member, council member, council member. We're running millions of dollars of TV ads. We've got every feasible form of communication going. And we're just beating the living fuck out of them. And then eventually enough council members went to the speaker and just like, we're not taking this hit for you guys.
Yeah.
And we get called, okay, can you meet with the speaker? And I remember we make this long list of like things we could give, right? Like, here are the concessions we can live with. So the guy named Josh Moore, who was the GM for Uber New York. So Josh, when people go, we keep me out of it, because like, I'm the boogeyman that they can say, like, if we don't get this done, we're going to stick him on you again. And I'm waiting, waiting, waiting. And then I get a text and it says, we're good. I said, what do you mean? He's like, they gave up. And I'm like, so what do we give? He's like, nothing. I'm like, what do you mean nothing? He said, they just wanted to take down the TV ads. I'm like,
done.
It's costing me $1 million a week. I can do that. They just wanted it to go away. Yeah, and that was it.
It's fucking crazy.
So it was great. But what was also so important is that because New York City is the media capital of the world, that was seen in Europe and Asia and South America. So it had a chilling effect on bad legislation everywhere, because every other mayor in the world saw what we did to the mayor of New York City. It's like, I don't want
to. Yeah, if you can do it to him, you definitely can do it to me.
Right.
What, before I forget, where can people get the book?
Oh, Amazon or Barnes & Noble or anything like that. It's called The Fixer. It's published by Random House. Came out in September of 2018. It's basically all stories like we've been talking about, both kind of the first half of my life was politics and second half is kind of Uber, and then into, you know, the 22 startups I've invested in and all these campaigns we've run, whether it's on fantasy sports or scooters or insurance or anything else.
Skirt, skirt. Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, Crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at Crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit Crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
One more word from our sponsor, BlockFi. Their new interest account allows you to securely deposit your Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. This rate actually compounds, so you receive a 6.2% APY, which is very attractive given the alternatives. So you can actually take your Bitcoin, you can deposit it with BlockFi, and get paid an interest rate of 6% in return. go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp to sign up and start earning interest on your crypto today.
Got it. While we're on the topic of Uber and Travis, talk us through. He obviously gets completely blindsided, goes through his whole experience from your seat, being friends with him, having seen kind of his resolve and frankly determination going up against, you know, what to me would be insurmountable odds time and time and time again, not only building a company but regulations, etc. Kind of what was your whole take on the situation that that he went through?
So, you know, look, he's the only person that I know that could have achieved what he achieved, right? And the problem is people are two sides of the same coin. So in order to be ruthless and tough enough to face down and break a cartel that, by the way,
like a legit cartel. This isn't like, oh, those guys are like the bullies.
No, don't break your legs. Yeah. Like, this is real, right? There's guns involved and shit, you know. To be tough enough, you're probably then not also going to be the softest, most like empathetic person in other parts of your life, right? And so where he fell short is he had this sort of consuming ambition and pursued it with just incredible relentlessness, and he was really good at innovating. But you know, as the company went from a scrappy startup to a big company, in terms of workplace culture, it didn't really occur to him, I think, in, you know, I'm not sure he would agree with this, but I would say I don't think it really occurred to him that you have to sort of change the nature of the workplace and the culture as you're growing, for internal reasons, not just things that are related to the ROI one way or another.
Yeah.
And so that's where I think he fell flat. I think also, in my experience with him, he knew what he didn't know. And so if we said, hey, this is what needs to be in politics, he would usually agree. I'm not sure that that was true across the board. So what it sounds like is that the HR people were so afraid to tell him bad news. And it's his fault for creating an environment where people are afraid to tell him bad news. But by that happening, bad shit was happening. He wasn't doing the bad things, but he also wasn't stopping it because they weren't even willing to tell him about it. And ultimately, if you're the CEO, you own it. But you know, what ended up being kind of really a problem for Uber shareholders, including me, is the board was so desperate to stop being attacked, right? Because they were getting hit by name on all these different podcasts and everything else, that the guy they appointed, they said, let's get a guy who would just take the temperature down. And they did. And Dara, you know, came as the CEO of Expedia. He'd be great at running Johnson & Johnson. He'd be great at running the U.S. Department of Commerce. He could run Princeton University. He's a terrific manager. He's not an innovator in any way, shape, or form. And what they forgot about is the market for a tech company wants an innovator, right? No one's betting on Uber because of its cash flow today. It loses money. You're betting on the future, and you have to believe this is the guy that's going to say all cars will drive themselves and we'll get it by pressing a button and everything else. And when you lose all faith in the company's ability to innovate, the stock goes down, and we're down 40% since the IPO in May.
It is pretty crazy how diabolically opposed those two things are, right? It's almost like the perspective of the company and the kind of, you know, wokeness of society today and expectations and things that are, look, frankly, very valid concerns about a business and culture, et cetera, can be the opposite of the innovator and cash flows, etc. Now, before everyone freaks out on Twitter, right, those two things don't have to always be opposite, right? There are people who get them right, but the people who are really good at one extreme are usually not good at both extremes.
Right. And so it's interesting. So you can look at this, and I think we work in some ways, or Tesla are examples that also you could look at, which is, you can't, if you're a VC, right, you can't not invest in the slightly crazy genius, because that's where the sort of really radical good stuff tends to happen, right? So you don't want to pass up a Travis Kalanick or an Elon Musk. At the same time, the game plan, like, hey, we'll just switch that person out with a good manager for the IPO, doesn't work, as we saw with Uber, right? So you need to invest in these people that are kind of crazy. You need to keep innovating, but at the same time, you need to understand where they're going to go wrong and put some controls in place. And I think one of the things that the VC world as a whole is really guilty is that everybody wants to win the deal. Everybody wants to get an allocation. And the easiest way to do it is to tell the founder whatever they want to hear. So you're going to have dual class voting chairs? No problem. You determine the line of succession for the next 100 years? No problem.
If you die?
Yeah, if you die,
you're still in control.
Yeah, right. You want a corporate jet? No problem. And when people never hear no and they get out of control, you know, they lose all perspective completely. And it's really incumbent upon all of us to say, yes, we're competing with each other. Yes, you know, we want to win the deal. But if we don't insist on some level of governance and standards, this is going to keep happening time and time again. Mm-hmm. I think we're at a moment now, especially with the implosion of WeWork, that people are at least understanding this. Mm-hmm. Whether people actually act on it, I don't know. Right? Yeah. Like, I know that we turned down a deal a couple months ago because we were going to put down a term sheet. We were about to do it. And then the structure that she showed us was so out of control that when we objected to it and she said, okay, no problem, I'll switch it, we were like, you know what? If this is your mindset at the seed, pre-seed, I was like, what are you going to be like by the B and C? Like, forget it, we're out. But, you know, oftentimes you overlook that stuff, and that's mm-hmm. what leads to this.
Yeah, for sure. You start with Uber, and you took equity, obviously, for services.
Yep.
You since have raised funds, and mm-hmm. now kind of you continue to do a lot of the lobbying and servicing and campaigns, et cetera. But you also have a fund. How do you talk about your business
today? Our model is definitely weird, unique, different, for better or for worse, which is we're the only venture fund that I'm aware of that invests at the intersection of politics and technology.
That's like the antithesis of almost every other venture fund.
Totally, which is why raising Fund 1 was so hard. Yeah. But you know, what we look for are the same things that any other VC. We care about the TAM and the founder and the underlying tech and the vision. But then the other thing that we really like is there some sort of big gating political regulatory issue mm-hmm. that if it's solved can really unlock growth, and if it's mm-hmm. not can really hinder growth? And if so, do we think we can solve it? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is yes and yes, that's where we want to deploy capital. So we invested in Bird at the Series A and then ran campaigns to legalize electric scooters. We invested in Lemonade at the Series A and then ran campaigns against the insurance industry to get them their licenses in every state. Invested in FanDuel, then ran campaigns in 23 states to legalize fantasy sports. And things like that where mm-hmm. we say, is there some area where our particular expertise is really unique mm-hmm. and that A, lets us make hopefully good choices, but B, gets us deal flow and access? Because if you're a founder mm-hmm. and you want our help, I've got to have investment rights. You know, and if I don't have them, I'm not going to work with you.
Look, I'm super tapped into a lot of venture capital stuff. As somebody said to me, I need somebody to solve a regulatory problem. You guys are probably the only one that I would think of.
Well, right now, we have a monopoly. Look, I got really lucky in that like a lot of things broke right, in the sense that typically people who start the kind of political consulting firm that I did, you sell it to like there are these big holding companies, mm-hmm. WPP or Omnicom. I just didn't ever want to work for anybody else. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm not going to sell, which gave me the independence.
We'll be best friends.
Right. I had the money that I made from Uber, so I had financial independence. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty risk friendly. You know, my two main kind of credentials were Mike Bloomberg and Uber, right? So those were pretty good. And so all of that, and my consulting business was profitable enough that I could basically say, I'm going to build out this huge infrastructure to run all these campaigns to solve mm-hmm. these problems for startups, and that's going to cost me a lot of money, but I'll get it back either in equity or in deal flow, mm-hmm. And it will ultimately make me a lot more money. All of those things came together in a weird way to let mm-hmm. me do this. So right now, we're the only ones who do it. Will someone copy us? Yeah, of course. You know, more power to them.
Yeah, but it's also, you can't stumble into it, right? Tomorrow, if I said, hey, I like that strategy, I'm going to go pursue that strategy, I can't go do it, right? I don't have the skill set. I don't have the experience. I don't have the connections, et cetera.
And you have to have the DNA. So Andreessen Horowitz, for example, set up a kind of public policy group, and brilliant people, the general counsel of Facebook, people from the NSA, really talented. But, you know, it was the starting point was venture and tech, not politics. And most tech regulation really happens at the municipal level, the state level, and it's like street fighting. You know, mm-hmm. it's like getting in there and just, you know, blooding up a regulator or a city council member. And if that's not if you don't love that, I love that shit.
Yeah, right? It's the hand-to-hand combat of literally we're gonna go meet with the the House Speaker, here's our list of demands, and walking out, and all they want us to get stop running the fucking TV ads.
Exactly. So if you like that stuff, it's really fun. Hard, but mm-hmm. really fun. If that's not your DNA, it's really hard to win these campaigns. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Let's talk a little bit, because you're doing a lot of the investing stuff, you've got two things around blockchain, crypto, Bitcoin, et cetera, that I want to talk about. First, let's go to just Bitcoin and kind of the crypto investing you've done.
Yeah.
Just walk us through what have you done there?
Yeah, so we're investors out of the fund in Coinbase, Circle, and we call Radar Relay, which mm-hmm. is a, don't know if you know that.
Yep.
And then separately from that, on the consulting side, we do some work with Tezos. We worked on this crazy project to create the first ever sovereign cryptocurrency for the Marshall Islands.
Oh yeah, I've heard about this.
Yeah, it didn't happen, but it was conceptually really interesting. I was mm-hmm. like, all right, I want to be involved in this thing.
Did you take tokens?
Yeah, that became worth nothing. But yes, I did. Here's my thesis, and I don't think it's different than most people listening to this podcast, which is, so I'm not a trader. Mm-hmm. I don't buy or sell any particular currency because I have no ability to know if it's going to go up or down.
Same.
There are people that have that skill set. God bless them, not me.
Yep.
But what I saw in politics is the world has changed. People don't have faith in institutions the way they used to. And by that can be the government, the mm-hmm. media, the church, higher ed, you know, Wall Street. But yep. across the board, there's just a lack of faith in central institutions. And when there's a vacuum of faith, it's got to go somewhere, mm-hmm. right? And one place that it goes is Bitcoin and Ethereum and the mm-hmm. notion of, hey, we don't really trust a central government to set monetary policy in a way that's not totally rigged. Mm-hmm. We'd rather take our own chances with ourselves and self-govern. And I think that that makes sense. Like, is that most of the population? No. But is it 5%, 10%, 15%? Yeah. And mm-hmm. like, that's pretty big, right? That's 100%.
We're at 1% now, most likely.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think it can get much bigger. And so if you believe that, the reason why all of our investments have been on the exchange side is mm-hmm. whether it goes up or down, if you believe that people have this lack of faith in institutions and that they would rather instead, you know, find an alternative way to trade their money and invest their money, if you're making money on the trade regardless, mm-hmm. right, because you're just processing it one way or the other, to me, that's a good business to be in. So we focus mainly on the exchanges so far, but we, you know, it's a fascinating world. So that's been half of it. Then the other half of it, and this will now, I think, make some sense given this conversation we've had, which is, so because I took my fee in Uber and equity, like I said to you, I'm like the Facebook mural guy. So I now have Tuss Philanthropies.
Well, the story, so just so people get the reference, is there's a guy who painted a mural at Facebook, and he walked away. They paid him in equity, and I think it ended up being worth $200 million.
Which is more than I made, to be clear. But I made enough.
And you did real work, right?
Yeah, I did a lot of work. I mean, I'm sure that guy's very talented.
And he probably enjoyed what he was doing, yeah, right? But he wasn't street fighting with the mayor of New York.
But, you know, I like that shit. But so the thing I learned in politics, and we've talked about this, is every policy output is the result of a political input.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accept the fact that 99.9% of politicians are desperately insecure, self-loathing people that can't live without the validation of holding office, then you understand that every decision they make is solely based on re-election. Mm-hmm. Asking them to go without that job, without the validation, feeling like there's somebody, feeling relevant, it's like asking you or me to go without oxygen. They can't do it.
Yep.
If you said to Chuck Schumer, Chuck, you got a choice. Tomorrow you can die or you can live, but no one will ever utter your name again. He would honestly say, like, what's the difference, right? And he wouldn't be able to understand the difference, right? So they have to have that. So expecting them to make choices in their votes or their policies, they're going to lose them the next election, is unrealistic. So if you want to change the outputs, you got to change the inputs. And the question is, what are the inputs? The inputs are votes. And because of gerrymandering, mm-hmm. the reality is almost every election in this country is decided in the primary, not in the general election.
Explain gerrymandering.
So gerrymandering is a practice that's awful but legal, where both parties, depending on who's in power in a particular state, draws the legislative districts. And they draw them in ways that literally like go block by block to make sure that only a Republican can win in that seat or only a Democrat. And both parties are equally guilty of it. Both parties say they're better than the other, but the reality is they're both totally doing. They're both corrupt. But as a result, so there's like 435 seats in the House, 380, 390 are decided in the primary, and then maybe the other remaining handful of general election,
right? And just to kind of drill down on what you're talking about, they literally pull up a map and they draw a line and they say, hey, this section or this kind of jurisdiction.
It could be literally this street, mm-hmm. this guy's house. I mean, mm-hmm. it runs in these crazy, crazy ways.
Well, when you look at the maps, it's not like they drew, you know, like New York City street grid. You know, it's not like they put that on. It's literally like, why does it run up and then this really long sliver?
There's a district, if you know New York City geography, that runs from the Coney Island all the way through the Upper West Side. It's Jerry Nadler's seat. that's insane, right? That's a really long way, but it's this long, long sliver of very left-wing votes the whole way up, right? And so because of that, where the real elections happen is the primary most of the time, mm-hmm. not the general election. Do you know what average turnout is in primaries?
Less than 10% of population.
It's about 15.
15.
So what happens is usually the hardest core, either left-wing or right-wing mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. are the ones who care enough to go vote in a primary. Mm-hmm. So if you are any kind of politician, you're saying, this is who I got to make happy, right? So, mm-hmm. like, when the politicians in Queens kicked out Amazon, while I would argue it was terrible for the city that they did it, they were right in that the people who actually show up and vote in their primary hate Amazon, and politically, it was the logical choice. Or, you know, you're a Republican congressman from Florida, and your district is gerrymandered, turnout is 12% in your primary. You probably know that an assault weapon ban makes sense, right? You don't want people walking around your district with an AK-47. But if the NRA is half that 12%, you're never going to vote for it because you're just giving up your seat. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes, but what if turnout were 60%? And when that hit me, it was when we were doing all the Uber stuff, and all of a sudden millions of people who never vote in primaries mm-hmm. were all of a sudden engaging politically. It's like, oh, it's not that everyone's apathetic. It's that we make it too hard, right?
Make it too hard, and it's also really hard to understand what they're doing.
Right,
right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's like I have to physically drive to a voting center. Like, basically, fuck that.
No, people don't right. do it. It just doesn't happen, yeah. right? And, I mean, the reason why, the system was created 250 years ago for an agrarian society. We vote on Tuesdays because that's what made sense for the farmers in the 1700s, right? And they've kept it that way because the people in power, that's how they have power. So the only two things that matter are kind of ideological primary voters or groups with enough money to kind of move and shape votes within primaries. Mm-hmm. So that's who has all the power. So if only the most radical on each side are the only things that have any inputs that matter, of course we can't pass legislation on climate change or guns or immigration or healthcare mm-hmm. or education or anything else, because that 70% that basically agrees on most stuff, you know, with some differences, they don't participate, which means they don't count. Mm-hmm. And so the question I asked was, could we find a way to get turnout from 12, 15% to 60, 70%? And then when blockchain came along, all of a sudden we're like, holy shit, the answer might be yes. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we knew from Uber that people would engage, but obviously the way that we were doing it was not secure. We were just sending text and an email. It was fine for what we were doing, right? Mm-hmm. Voting is a more complicated process. But blockchain, as everyone listening to this podcast definitely knows, obviously is a lot harder to hack and creates a permanent record. And you know if anything has been mm-hmm. changed right away. And so the question was, can we start running elections over the blockchain mm-hmm. and allow people to vote that way from their phone? So we started the state of West Virginia. Mm-hmm. An employee of mine, her mom happened to be the U.S. senator from there. And so I called her and said, hey, any ideas on someone who might want to try this idea? And the secretary of state there, Mac Warner, is a military guy. All four mm-hmm. of his kids are in the military. And it's very hard to vote during the military. Like, you know, you mail in your ballot from Kandahar and it shows up a month later, it gets thrown in the trash, right?
So I was literally in Iraq when the 2008 election happened.
Yeah.
And I remember 90%+ of the guys yeah. didn't vote.
Right. And
just because it was too hard.
You're, and
like,
you're all
and it doesn't matter.
Risking your life to protect our right to vote. Literally. Right? So my view was, let me start with the hardest thing to object to, which is who could object to make it easier for soldiers to vote, yep. right? And Mac agreed. And so the state of West Virginia, to their credit, said, hey, let's give this thing a try. I paid for the state's cost to administer the election out of my foundation so that it wouldn't be a taxpayer expense, and then we could avoid all the procurement stuff and RFPs and all that other stuff. I don't invest in the companies that are doing this because I want to really not care who wins. I just want to mm-hmm. see it happen. At the moment, the leading company is called Votes. It's a blockchain company out of Boston, VOATZ. And the way it works is they verify you. You take a video of your face and that gets matched up against your ID for facial recognition scan, then your biometric fingerprint. Once those two things are verified, then the app is like, you know, pick the Bachelor or voting for the All-Star game or whatever it is, but transmit it over the blockchain. It's on a private ledger. And then when it hits the Secretary of State's office, they print out a paper copy of the ballot so that it can be audited. Mm-hmm. And we did it in West Virginia. Multiple audits were done. I've got a team of former FBI cyber agents who work for me now, because I need this stuff to work, otherwise mm-hmm. it doesn't do me any good. And they're auditing it, and the National Cybersecurity Center's auditing it. It worked, and then the city of Denver did it this past spring.
What'd they do it for?
Military. Mm-hmm. Utah County did it for military. When is this going to run?
Next week.
When next week?
You tell me when you want it to
well,
run.
Well, so I think we're good. So on Monday, we have a big announcement.
Okay, let's hear the announcement. We'll make this go after Monday.
Yeah, so
so you're listening to this, and it's already been released.
This is the first time I've said this publicly. Utah is now allowing people with disabilities to also vote on their phone over blockchain.
Oh,
so,
awesome.
Because if you're blind, I hadn't really thought about it until it came up. It's like, it's a pain in the ass for us to vote. Imagine mm-hmm. you're blind. You got to get there. And then you got to trust that the person who's helping you is actually recording the vote the way you want. For all you know, they're mm-hmm. voting for the opposite, for who they want, right? Mm-hmm. Horrible. So Utah
County... How does that work if you're blind on your phone?
You They have different devices that have Braille and things like that. Like,
got it.
We didn't really thought about it either, but apparently we start talking to advocates for the blind, like, no, smartphones are like the greatest thing ever to happen.
Yeah.
We would love to be able to vote this way. So blind, deaf.
There's basically a smart computer with Braille where I can engage with it and it thinks for me and I can ensure exactly what it's right. doing. Yeah, yeah. It makes a ton of sense.
So Utah will become the first jurisdiction to allow another demographic to do it. Mm-hmm. And look, my strategy is kind of obvious, which is I'm starting with all the unobjectionable groups and trying to work my way into the middle. Mm-hmm. We're also going to announce next week a couple of counties in other states. We'll be up to five different jurisdictions doing it. In each case, you know, we're doing three things. One is we're convincing election officials to give it a try, and then I'm paying for all the costs of administering mm-hmm. these elections, which I can do for a while. I can't do indefinitely, but I made enough money that I can do it for a while. Mm-hmm. We are working with, and this is one of the reasons I really want to come on the podcast, quite frankly, is blockchain startups. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in doing this, we will give you a lot of the expertise you need as to how you deal with voting, how mm-hmm. you deal with the politicians. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of the blocking tackling. We're providing the resources.
If somebody is interested in this, how do they get in touch with you?
Just go to mobilevoting.org. There's a contact sheet on there. And if you're interested, we actively are constantly talking to different blockchain companies mm-hmm. because we want to work with you.
Can this solution be built by the government, or does it have to be private enterprise?
That's a good question. Could it? Yes, of course it could. And we've had conversations with DARPA about it. Mm. Having run a government, my faith tends to be more in private enterprise. So what I would like to see is five or six companies competing with each other mm-hmm. and constantly trying to innovate the other, mm-hmm. Doing this type of work. So that's what I'd like to. If that can happen, you know, I've also thought about, do I just kind of incubate it myself and kind of create an open API? I'm willing to do that if I need to, mm-hmm. but I would rather see private enterprise do it. I think that's just a better way to go.
Yeah. How long till you think we can get to a presidential election in the United States done with mobile voting?
Yeah. So, well, look, some next year, I'm confident there will be some votes in the presidential recorded over blockchain.
Oh, you think so?
Well, all of the votes so far, they're real votes. So
But they're state.
So what was last, West Virginia was senator, governor.
Okay.
Denver was mayor.
Yep. Yeah, these aren't city council.
It's just whatever is on the ballot, right?
Yeah,
it could be city council, could be president. Yeah. So the stuff, whatever we do next year, it's going to be president by and large.
That's awesome.
2028, sort of my internal, it's just in my head, mm-hmm. deadline of like when I'd want that every single person can just do this thing. I'd love to get it done faster. The other timeline I use is my daughter's 13, and so she'll be a voting age in 5 years. What do I need to do in the next 5 years that when the powers that be say to her, no, you can't do this, it's not safe, she could say, bullshit. It's been proven 50 mm-hmm. times over. They've done mm-hmm. it in all these places. All these people have tried it. Mm-hmm. You just don't want me to do it this way, right? It's not safe.
What do you think the impact is if there's mobile voting?
I mean, I believe that fundamentally it saves the Republic. Right now, if you look at the state of Washington, you look at the state of the world, it is so binary and it's so oppositional. Mm-hmm. You kind of have a red state world and a blue state world, and mm-hmm. they're so different from each other that if we can't start passing bills and coming up with policies that we can agree on some level, eventually we're going to, you know, Alabama say we don't want to be in the same country as California, mm-hmm. and California say thing with the same country as Alabama, and we're going to become multiple countries.
Yeah.
And the only way to keep the union together, I would argue, is to start passing stuff. And that's the bad news is the system really prohibits that. The good news is on most issues, the middle 70%. More or less agree, right?
Yeah.
Take guns. The 70% would say we shouldn't confiscate people's weapons. The Second Amendment is a real thing, but people don't need assault weapons, right? Mm-hmm. They tend to be fairly common sense solutions on any given issue.
Yeah.
You know, immigration. No one wants to really deport, other than the crazy 15% of the right, no one wants to deport all of the current immigrants here, but mm-hmm. most people do think there should be some level of border security and things like that.
Well, and it goes to this idea of like, take immigration, right? My girlfriend, which you know, comes from Eastern Europe, and we talk all the time. It's like, look, the law is the law, but at the same time, like, maybe we should change the laws.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why is it so difficult to immigrate here?
Right. It shouldn't be, especially in tech, where it's like, we're literally throwing talent out, the money out the window. That's just
craziness.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember Romney had, when he was smart, he was smart. When he was running for office, he said, like, I would staple a visa to like every foreign acceptance to like Stanford or whatever, of a foreign student to like Harvard or Stanford or whatever. It's like, here you go.
Yep.
We want you here.
Yeah.
Which was the logical policy from an economic standpoint. So I'm trying to build a movement around this thing. So part of it are things like this where you mm-hmm. give me a chance to talk about it publicly.
I'll do it one step further. So you we've never talked about this before. You don't know this, but when I was at Facebook, I worked on voter registration.
Oh.
And so there was a team that now known as Social Good and Goodwill, I think is what they still call it. And the general mandate of the team was, hey, go use all of the resources of Facebook and all of kind of the user base and distribution and data and all stuff. Build products that are pretty undeniably good for the world, right? Yep. And don't worry about making money. So donations for, you know, causes, like all this kind of stuff. And one of the products that we built was a voter registration that it was a card that went in the news feed. And so it didn't tell you to vote one way or the other. It didn't educate you on candidates. Didn't do any of this stuff. All it said was, you should be registered to vote. Yeah. Right. And I forget the exact data, so don't hold me to it. But it was like some material percent when we first launched it. We launched it in, I think it was the UK. It was like 30 or 40% of registered voters for that election came from that thing in like a week.
Yeah.
Well, that's the beauty of having everyone staring at the same screen is for when sure. you put, hey, you should just click this button and you're registered.
Now imagine it works. This button and you can actually vote. People will exactly. do it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
Facebook would never be allowed to do
no,
that.
No,
right?
no, especially not Facebook. But, you know, but and then, and by the way, the politicians will basically follow suit because yeah. they'll adapt whatever they have to adapt to stay in office, right? Yeah. So if they need to be able to be get stuff done, they'll get stuff done, right? That's yeah, yeah. the good news about how little they have in the way of principles is that you can at least, you know, adopt it to a way that's, that represents progress. So, you know, we're trying to just create a movement. I don't know if you can watch the show Billions, but we worked with them last year to do a mobile voting subplot. We're organizing college campuses. I'm running around the country giving speeches and, you know, just trying to basically, same thing that we did with Uber, I'm trying to let the genie out of the bottle. Because if I can show people, hey, there's a better way to do this thing, and they're like, oh. And not shockingly, in all the polling done of people who have now voted, the soldiers who have voted online or blockchain, they're like, yeah, this is much better. It had the one in Denver at 100% approval rating. First of all, 100%, I'm like, well, it wouldn't be bad if it wasn't 100%, right?
Well, what was and you'll know this, I don't remember the exact details, but what was it when Al Gore and like the Chad, the pieces Chad. Of
right.
papers?
Well, it's funny because the people who oppose me, one of the things they say is that any type of digital is dangerous. And they don't really understand what blockchain is per se, but no, blockchain is way too dangerous. Yeah.
Russia did misinformation on Facebook, so blockchain's
so bad. Right, they have no conception at all how these two things are totally different. So their answer is always paper, but literally the 2000 election was determined by Florida and was determined by people in West Palm Beach who either didn't punch the thing all the way through or they only punched it partially. And as a result, they couldn't tell who they voted for.
That's wild.
In fact, you had all, you know, they had in a heavily Jewish community, you had all these senior citizens who, according to the Hanging Chad, voted for Pat Buchanan. They clearly did not mean to vote for Pat Buchanan. They were trying to vote for Gore, right? It's like, of course we know that. And had that not happened, Gore's president, I don't know if the Iraq war happens. I mean, history is probably pretty different right now. Climate change would be hopefully much less of an issue because that was his thing. So paper had pretty fucking significant problems too.
You think Al Gore invented the internet?
He thinks he does. it's funny. So I've spent a little time looking into this because it's such a... People will give him credit for he led the way in Congress for appropriations to help facilitate it.
Okay.
So like in terms of DOD getting money to work on the project, yes.
He gets some credit there.
He didn't write a single lot of code or anything else like that. He gets some credit for at least believing in it early. But somehow how that translates to invented the internet, I don't know.
So the first time I ever heard like kind of the meme, right, I was like, wait, what? And I remember Googling around and I was like, oh, like people actually believe this.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was like, okay. Because you're here and you're so, you've got this interesting perspective because you understand tech, you understand politics, and you understand regulations. Just Trump, the presidency, geopolitics globally, like how do you just think about all this?
So we're in a crazy fucking world right now.
And that's true across the world, not just US, but just across the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, my wife the other day were trying to like say like, okay, what countries seem to be like, have their shit together and doing it right?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Who would you come up with?
Very few. So maybe Merkel in Germany, but she has to leave. They pushed her out. You would have said Trudeau in Canada, but he's now about to get thrown out of office. He had a terrible scandal. It turned out he was constantly putting on blackface and costume. I don't understand why you would do that, but
The thing I saw was he said he was Aladdin at one point.
It turns out he's done it like 10 times.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. The UK is a disaster. I guess France is not terrible right now. You know, you have lots of oligarchs or despots in places like the Philippines or Turkey or Putin, China.
Well, I was going to say Russia and China. What's the kind of thoughts there? Obviously not everything's going well.
No, I mean, you have these two countries that obviously are looking out for themselves and don't engage in a democratic process, which means on one hand, it's easier to make decisions so they run better than we do. On the other hand, there's no human rights, right? And, you know, so that's that. This whole Hong Kong situation right now is really illustrative of that. So, you know, the world is screwed up all over the place. But in some ways, you have to wonder, is that partly because if the U.S. is like, when they say when the head catches a cold, the body gets the flu or whatever, the cliche. But like, because the U.S. is so wacky right now, is that then ripple effect that everything has gone off the rails across the board? Maybe, right? So it would seem to me that the number one thing you would want in the presidency would just be someone who can not be Trump, right? And I, you know, personally, I wish Mike Bloomberg had run. Like, personally, to me, he would have been the best person to be president. But the reality is...
You think he'll ever run?
Nah, he's 77. I think the last opportunity was this, and he didn't do it. But I'll take anyone, right? So if you told me it would be Warren, she's not really my kind of candidate, but I'd say okay. If it's Mitt Romney, nope, great. You know, like, so...
Bernie?
I mean, he's not my guy, but yeah, I'll take him over Trump any day.
Really?
For sure.
Andrew Yang?
I kind of like Yang.
So, all right, we got to talk about him. Ready? Because here's my thing. So I saw him in Philly before he really kind of kicked off the whole thing, right? And I remember kind of being like, that guy's... I don't know. I couldn't figure him out, right? And then when I saw him running, my whole take on him is he's probably got the right platform. He's probably too early.
Yeah. So, but if
right, like somebody's going to win with that platform, it's just not this election.
So think about it. So, like in 16, Bernie's arguing Medicare for all. And in 20, it's a mainstream concept. You have to sort of take these ideas and put them out there to the bloodstream, and it takes time to become normal. But where I kind of keep coming closer and closer to Yang is, so Warren has this 2% wealth tax idea, right? And on one hand, it sounds totally, you know, confiscatory or however you say that word. On the other hand, you know, when Jeff Bezos is worth $180 billion, like, hey, maybe she's got a point. But
well,
then,
he's only got 90 of it now, right?
Oh, because McKinsey's got the other 90, right. So either way. But then when you understand government, say, okay, we can put all this money into the tax, into taxes, but most of it's going to be wasted because government's not good at running most of these programs. So Yang's idea is maybe not bad, which is let's take some money away from those who have it. Let's give it to those who need it. But let's not, let's just route it around government through UBI, right? Universal Basic Income. That may not be a bad idea. Now, the mechanics of it are tricky, and having spent so much time in corrupt places like Illinois, like the ability to shield it from politicians sticking their hands in the pot, I'm not sure about. So, like, it's more complicated. I don't know.
But this is where crypto, I think crypto,
but crypto
can,
could be part of that for sure.
Yeah, and there's two pieces, right? There's one, like, you know, there's a guy, Alex Gladstein, who's the chief strategy officer at the Human Rights Foundation. And one of the things he's super excited about with Bitcoin and crypto is foreign aid. So when we go give foreign aid to most of these countries, it goes into a bank account, and everyone's got their, you know, hand in the cookie jar. And 40% of it ends up going to the people who was intended for. And the other 60% ends up in, you know, the president, the dictator's brother, everyone in their family. And then there's, you know, money that's put into the Rolls Royce that drives everyone around. Right. I mean, it's just crazy shit. And so with this, you could, you know, essentially airdrop or deposit right into digital wallets. You know exactly who got it. You can track it on the blockchain, all this kind of stuff. The other piece of it, and where I come out on like the UBI stuff, which I still don't know exactly how this works, but just from a concept standpoint, we create a lot of fucking value that we don't monetize. All of our data, all of this stuff. Yeah. And when you get into blockchains and digital wallets and all this stuff, is there a way for, you know, rather than the government hand you $1,000 a month, could you actually just sell your digital data to corporations, researchers, all this stuff, and you actually might make more money, right? And then what you do is it's another way of kind of routing around the government being involved, right?
No, that's interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know. What's your take on Bitcoin specifically? Kind of how do you view that in, you know, in concert with a lot of the political stuff that's going on and the mobile voting and just kind of?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's. So on one hand, my fund has investments in exchanges where Bitcoin is clearly the most important currency. And so I want Bitcoin to do well because that ultimately means, you know, the value of the exchanges tend to go in parallel with Bitcoin.
For sure.
So I care a lot about that. On the other hand, Bitcoin is a little problematic for me because almost nobody who's not like a listener to your podcast like understands between blockchain and Bitcoin, right? And so when something weird happens with Bitcoin, then like my voting thing gets attacked. They're like, see, you can't do this. I'm like, it's got nothing to do with Bitcoin, right? Like, we're not even, you know, so like, we're not even on the ledger. Like, you know, so, but it, that's, it's sometimes from a narrative perspective makes my life a little more complicated. With that said, you know, you're seeing interesting things. The state of Ohio is taking tax receipts now on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. There was a candidate, Brian Ford, ran for Congress last time, who took his donations via Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're seeing places chipping where it's away. Starting to enter life. And that's the more and more applications that real people can relate to, the more they'll start to understand it, the more they can distinguish it from Ethereum or blockchain or anything else, and the more mainstream it becomes. So, yeah, I'm for every, you know, I feel like I do spend a decent amount of time talking to politicians and kind of urging them to say, look, why don't you see how you can incorporate crypto, whatever, you know, Bitcoin, I don't care, right, into what you do, because it has potentially some great ways to ensure provenance and security and make sure the money goes where it's supposed to go. And it also takes a group of people who tend to be a little alienated from government and maybe gives them a little bit of faith and a little bit of trust. Mm-hmm. I think we could use that right now.
For sure. Before I wrap up, I got two questions, and then you get to end asking me a question.
Okay.
Favorite book, and you can't name one that you wrote.
All right, so not my book. I read a lot, right? I read mainly fiction. So I'm going to give you
two. Oh, you read more fiction than nonfiction?
I read about 2/3 fiction, 1/3 nonfiction.
I'm like 100% nonfiction.
You're not. Apparently, I'm the gender divide is usually the way you are, okay, which is men tend to read more nonfiction, women more fiction, but I like fiction. So the best book I read this year is a novel called Boy Swallows World by a guy named Trent Dalton. It's this crazy book about this kid in Australia, but it's just kind of wonderful.
Yeah, and a fiction book.
Fiction. Yep. And then I would say, sometimes I get asked this question, is when I was in like the fifth grade, I read this book called Advise and Consent about like a U.S. Senate confirmation fight in like the 1950s, and that was what got me interested in politics. And so that book had a really big impact on my life. Yeah. I haven't read it since, but people say it's by a guy named Alan Drury, but you know, that's how I learned what politics was and sort of set me on this path.
The best books are all about not only the book, but also when you read them.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
The,
yeah, exactly.
The timing is really important.
Life, totally.
Yeah. Before you ask me the question, aliens, believer, non-believer?
Yeah, I believe.
Why?
I mean, because the notion that we are the entirety of the universe is insane to me. Now, they may not be anything like what we see in the movies, right? I have no idea what form they take. It could be moss. But we know for a fact that there is some bacteria on Mars, right? Some water. So, like, in a sense, that's already an alien, right? So, yes, could there be beings that are a lot smarter than us? Sure. Could there be beings that, like, could we turn out to be the most sophisticated being in the universe? Maybe. I hope not, but maybe. But either way, it seems so insanely narcissistic to say that it's just us, right? Like, we know now that there are all these galaxies and all universes and all these planets, and we can only, in the same way we can only access, what, 3-5% of our brain, we're only accessing a tiny, tiny piece of the entire system, right? Whatever word you want to use for it. And, like, so clearly a lot of shit's got to be out there. And, look, whether we ever interact with it in our lifetime, I don't know, but... But yeah, you know, it may not be what the Area 51 kind of concept, but I almost don't understand how the answer could be no. What do you think?
Well, I've asked almost 200 people now, so I've got a lot of different answers, and the three most common and all ones that I agree with. So one is yours, which is basically like it's super selfish to think that we aren't, or that we are the only ones. Two is mathematically, just the probability is off the charts. And then the third, which is more my favorite, and I don't really have an opinion about, which is we may not want to discover if there's aliens, right? Like if somebody invades Earth, like it's not usually turned out very well for people who have been somewhere that's been invaded.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we always think about like, oh, it'd be so cool to like know if there's other life out there, but nobody ever thinks about the downside of like, actually, maybe you might not want to know, right? If we aren't the most sophisticated, intelligent beings.
Assuming they're belligerent. Maybe that species has evolved beyond that, right? And so as a result, maybe that they wouldn't. Who the fuck knows? But like, you know, the same way you got to have an open mind to most things in life, I think to me you have to have that. So I got to ask you a question now?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, okay, this is sort of based on what I do, but like, all right, you've done 200 of these.
Yep.
You're an expert in crypto. You're an expert in blockchain.
I don't know about all that, but go ahead.
I'm going to argue you are. What should government be doing to facilitate the development of all this?
That's a great question. Three things. One, I think the U.S. specifically, and I've talked about this publicly before, I think they should digitize the dollar immediately, and mainly because it's not going to be a competition between digital versus non-digital currencies. It's going to be digital versus digital, and so the competition is at the monetary policy level. And the first one or two nation-backed superpower currencies that get digitized will be more accessible than the rest, and therefore accessibility leads to adoption.
It becomes a standard.
And if everyone in, you know, Africa and South America, et cetera, adopts the digital yuan because the dollar isn't digital, right, in the sense of tokenized, huge problem for the U.S. dollar, right? So I think that's a, that's one piece that wasn't talked about 12 months ago. I think now the couple of congressmen are kind of catching on to this, so that's good. Two is I actually think very similarly, the U.S. Central Bank should go and put a bunch of Bitcoin in its reserves. And I look at it as less about they think that it's going to go to, you know, $100,000, $1 million, whatever. It's more of it will be more costly for them to have not done it than to do it and it all go to zero, right? So kind of you look at it from like a prisoner's dilemma, like you actually are incentivized to do it, and whether it works out or not doesn't matter, but like that's the hedge.
Yeah, and I think, look, I mean, I know that even the people that manage my money, like there's a certain amount that's in alternative assets, hard assets, and one of those things is Bitcoin, right? Yeah. And that, but that's
non-correlated.
That's just logical math.
Yeah. So I think that's a big one. And then the third is actually similar to what you're doing with mobile voting, et cetera. It's just blockchain is just triple entry accounting, right? And it's done in an automated fashion. It keeps track of shit, right? And how it flows, whether it's votes, it's money, it's commodities, whatever. And so I think that the government should, I'm not a fan of like the government putting money into it per se, as much as like clearly establishing this is one of our national focuses. Yeah. We are going to heavily incentivize companies, you know, individuals, et cetera, to start working research, on this stuff and do it from the bent of blockchains can unlock automation. And if we are one of the first, if not the first country to really understand how automation can help. It kind of goes back to the Uber stuff, right? What is the production increase in the GDP if all of a sudden people aren't spending 2, 3, 4 hours a day driving a car, but instead can be doing other things? I don't know. I'm not a mathematician.
Pretty massive.
Yeah. I'm not a freaking economist, but somebody can figure out that like there's going to be an increase in productivity, right? And so you can kind of go down the line and say like, what are all the things that automation can unlock?
Right.
And I'm more in the camp of automation doesn't necessarily displace workers in like the fear mongering way. Throughout history, you know, was it 70% of people used to be farmers? Guess what? We're way more productive because now we've got all these machines that can do the farming and we're able to go do more higher impact things. I think the same thing will happen here. It's just we've really got to figure out how to unlock a lot of that.
Yep.
And so when that happens, I think it'll, you know, we'll be better off for it over time.
That's a good answer.
I just talked about it too much. All right, listen. Book, where can they get it?
Amazon, probably the easiest. Called The Fixer.
The Fixer.
Also, I have a podcast, which I'm hoping you'll it's called Firewall.
Firewall.
It's specifically about the intersection of tech and politics. Your girlfriend has been on it. Maybe you'll join us if you're willing at some point.
For sure.
And you can just get that on Spotify, iTunes, wherever.
Okay. And then mobile voting, you said it is?
Mobilevoting.org is the site that really has all the information on it. So if you want to understand the arguments for it, what's happening around it, what people are saying about it, articles, it's all right there. And then if you're interested in actually being involved, you know, you can put your information in and we'll be in touch.
How do people get in touch with you?
At Bradley Tusk on Twitter. It's probably the best way to do it.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much for doing this.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.